As Unitarian Universalists, we find wisdom and inspiration in many places. Jewish and Christian scriptures and other sacred texts, the arts, science, nature, our own experiences. Our tradition keeps us open to revelation from many sources. Today's wisdom comes from The Messiah is Among You, as told by Rosamund Stone Zonder and Benjamin Zonder. Once there was a monastery that had fallen on hard times. It was once part of a great order, which as a result of religious persecution in the 17th and 18th centuries had lost all of its branches. It was decimated to the extent that there were only 5 monks left in the mother house, the abbot and 4 others, all of whom were over 70. Clearly, it was a dying order. Deep in the woods surrounding the monastery was a little hut that the rabbi from a nearby town occasionally used as a hermitage. One day, it occurred to the abbot to visit the hermitage to see if the rabbi could offer any advice that might save the monastery. The rabbi welcomed the abbot and commiserated. "I know how it is," he said. "The spirit has gone out of people. Almost no one comes to the synagogue anymore." So the old rabbi and the old abbot wept together, and they read parts of the Torah and spoke quietly of deep things. The time came when the abbot had to leave. They embraced. "It has been wonderful being here with you," said the abbot, "but I have failed in my purpose for coming. Have you no piece of advice that might save the monastery?" "No, I am sorry," the rabbi responded. "I have no advice to give. The only thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you." When the other monks heard the rabbi's words, they wondered what possible significance they might have. "The Messiah is one of us? One of us here at the monastery? Do you suppose he met the abbot? I mean, of course, it must be the abbot who has been our leader for so long. On the other hand, it might have been Brother Thomas, who is undoubtedly a holy man. Certainly he couldn't have met Brother Elrod. He's so crotchety. But then, Elrod is very wise. Surely he could not have met Brother Philip. He's too passive. But then, magically, he's always there when you need him. Of course, he didn't mean me. Yet, supposing he did. Oh, Lord, not me. I couldn't mean that much to you, could I?" As they contemplated in this manner, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect on the off chance that one of them might be the Messiah, and on the off chance that each monk himself might be the Messiah, they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Because the forest in which it was situated was beautiful, people occasionally came to visit the monastery, to picnic or to wander along the old paths, most of which led to the dilapidated chapel. They sensed the aura of extraordinary respect that surrounded the 5 old monks, permeating the atmosphere. They began to come more frequently, bringing their friends, and their friends brought friends. Some of the younger men who came to visit began to engage in conversation with the monks. After a while, one asked if he might join, then another, and another. Within a few years, the monastery became once again a thriving order, and, thanks to the rabbi's gift, a vibrant, authentic community of light and love for the whole realm.
There's a story that says that a man came across 3 stonemasons who were working at chipping chunks of granite from large blocks. The first seemed quite unhappy at his job, chipping away, frequently looking at his watch. When the man asked what it was that he was doing, the first mason responded rather curtly, "I'm hammering this rock and I can't wait till I can go home." Now, the second mason, seemingly more interested in his work, was hammering away diligently, and when asked what it was that he was doing, he said, "Well, I'm molding this block of rock so that it can be used with others to construct a wall. It's not bad work, but I'll be glad when it's done." Now, the third mason was hammering at his block fervently. taking time to stand back and admire his work. He would chip off small pieces until he was satisfied that it was the best that he could do. When he was questioned about his work, he stopped. He gazed skyward and he proudly proclaimed, "I am building a cathedral." Three men, all doing the same job, but three very different stories that help them make meaning out of their situation or not. Our lives are shaped by the stories we tell. As we look at our own lives and how we spend our days, do we look at them and say we are hammering rocks, or are we shaping a cathedral? The stories we tell about ourselves, individually and collectively, matter. How do we tell the fullest story we can of who we are? How do we leave room for new stories to be added? And how do we allow others to come into the fullness of their stories as well? We all have these stories that we tell about ourselves. And oftentimes our stories are full of all those moments when we believe we failed, all of the things we didn't do, promises we didn't keep. These stories do not leave room for much possibility. And many times they don't allow room for hope or growth or new learning. They're stories that cut us off from the fullness of life and potential. The research psychologist Tim Wilson, who works in a field called narrative therapy, tells us that good stories are the ones that give us a sense of purpose in life. We feel like we are working towards something and we're making progress toward it. It helps us find meaning in our experience. A good story is one that helps us make sense of life. Our lives and their pathways, he says, are not fixed in stone. They are shaped by story. The ways in which we understand and share the stories of our lives make all the difference. If we tell stories that emphasize only desolation, we become weaker. If we tell our stories in ways that make us stronger, we can soothe our losses, ease our sorrows. Learning how to re-envision the stories we tell about ourselves can make an enormous difference in the way we live our lives. Now, since the age of 7, I've carried a story given to me by someone else. It was given to me by my first grade teacher, Sister John of the Cross. I have very few memories of my childhood, and unfortunately, it's the ones like this one that stick with me. On this fine day, we were coloring a page, a picture of some sort, and I colored my whole picture blue. Now, my best friend at the time, Joey Nido, had pulled out his box of crayons, and he was going to town. He had every color of the rainbow on that page. Now, Sister John of the Cross pulled the two of us up to the front of the room with our pictures. And she wanted to talk to the class about creativity. She praised Joey's multicolored creation as being a thing of beauty. And mine was the bad example. The only time she talked about it was as the thing not to do, and pointed out that blue wasn't a very good color anyway. For years and years, I carried her story as my story. I was not creative, didn't have much color sense, and art and beauty were best left to others. Now, narrative therapists would call this a thin story. Thin stories are those that don't have a lot of complexity, and they're often imposed on us by other people, parents, teachers, those in authority. Because of their authority, we accept the story without question. Thick stories, on the other hand, are built from the real evidence of life. They're rich with detail. They explore our inner motives. They look at outward forces that may have made someone act the way they did. In narrative therapy, we're asked to examine those stories we tell about ourselves, create alternative stories to our thin stories, to thicken them, looking for nuance and complexity, to add in richness and detail. And then there are the stories that we tell about others. Thin stories make for thin relationships. So in the book that Rachel referenced, our reading was from this book called The Art of Possibility. Benjamin Zander gives us a case of a thin story, a letter that was written to him by a man named John Imhoff. And in this letter, John Imhoff says, "My dear Mr. Zander, you have just completed a presentation to the leadership of the North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System. I should immediately be returning to my job. But first, I need to sit down and tell you how you affected me today. I am the man who approached you and told you of my emotional reunion with my father during your presentation. My father was Swiss-German, and throughout my adult life, I have struggled to explain to myself why in the 25 years that he was with me, he could never even once say, 'I love you.' We did many things as a family, and I suppose his teachings in the form of admonishments have always remained with me, and that they softened some when I became a father myself. You told us to reflect on someone no longer in our lives as you played a piece of music. And I thought about my father, and I thought about this question I could never answer. And I thought about the story that I had told myself because of it. And my story was that my father never really loved me." And then, as if delivered by a bolt of lightning, I recalled an incident that occurred between us at least 45 years ago. I was an asthmatic child, and on so many evenings, I could not run to the door with my siblings to say hello to my father. I would instead remain upstairs in my bed, gasping for breath, waiting for my father to come up those stairs and say hello to me, and maybe, just maybe, say, "I love you." And then as I listened to that music, the memory came back of an evening all those years ago when again I was sick and he did come upstairs. But this one was different. He sat next to me on my bed, and as I was sitting upright and struggling for breath, he began to gently stroke my hair. And I remember wishing that it would last an eternity. Tears came to my eyes, and I knew that while he could not say those words, they were expressed even more poignantly in the gentle stroking of a little boy's hair by his father's powerful hands. I recall that as he sat with me, my asthma attack subsided. I had completely forgotten about that moment. I must have buried it in my own desire to keep my father at a distance, to prove that my story was right, that I was unlovable, that he was cold and he only cared about work. But it's not so. My father showed me love in so many other ways. If we could only examine and re-examine the stories we tell, we could open ourselves to the possibility that what we seek may have been in front of us all the time. Thank you, John Imhoff. These thin stories we tell not only shut us off from the possibilities that are awaiting us, but they close down the possibilities that are awaiting between us. Another way to look at it comes from a TED Talk called "The Danger of a Single Story," in which the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie warns of the dangers of creating thin stories. She calls them the single story. The single story, she says, is what you get when you compress all the complex stories of individuals or groups of individuals to a single oversimplified narrative. When you tell it enough time, those stories get internalized and we forget that they are stories. They can be stories that are given to us by others, like my story from Sister John. When someone else compresses the complexity of who we are into one story, and then we carry that with us. She offers an example of a time when she bought into a single story of another. She said, "I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. My father was a professor and my mother an administrator. So we had, as was the norm, live-in domestic help, who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new houseboy, and his name was Fide, and the only thing my mother ever said about him was that his family was very poor. My mother sent yams and rice and our old clothes to his family, and when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, 'Finish your food. Don't you know Fide's family has nothing?' So I felt nothing but enormous pity for his family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit, and his mother showed us this beautiful patterned basket that was made of dyed raffia that his brother had made, and I was startled. It had never occurred to me that anyone in Fide's family could actually make something. All I had heard about them was that they were poor, so it was impossible for me to see them as anything else. Poverty was my single story." And we know we are not a single story. We are a rich combination of multiple stories that create the tapestry of our lives. Adichie said, "What if my mother told me that Fide's family was poor? They are also very hardworking and creative, and they are makers of beauty." The process of creating the stories of our lives is a process of invention. We get to create the ones that bring us hope and meaning. We get to reject the ones that hold us back or harm us. And when we realize these stories are stories, we can change them, adapt them, add to them, make them more complex. When we create thick stories for ourselves, we're recognizing everything that we bring, our strengths and our talents, and we can find freedom and new life in these stories, and then we can help others find freedom as well. We are each multi-storied, and when we realize that, we are less likely to step into that trap of creating a thin single story of another person. Years later, Adichie left Nigeria for the United States to attend college, and she remembered this story of Fide and his family when she met her first roommate, who was shocked. The first thing she said to Adichie was, "Where did you learn English so well?" And she was surprised to learn that English is the official language of Nigeria. She asked if she could listen to Adichie's tribal music, and she was greatly disappointed when she pulled out a tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that Adichie didn't know how to use a stove. Her roommate had this story of her that was already written before they ever met, a story that was this well-meaning, patronizing pity. Her single story of an entire continent of people was one of catastrophe, one of which no one in that country could do a thing for themselves. You needed to be saved by a foreigner. "How do you do this?" she asked. "How do you create a single story?" Well, she said, "You show people as only one thing, over and over and over again. You tell a person they are only one thing over and over and over again, and they will come to believe you. they will come to believe they are that story. Our culture can tell thin stories, ones that do not reflect on the complexities of our world. One of the most common ones, you may have heard this one about our own country, is that we are a land of equal opportunity. That anyone can pull themselves up from their bootstraps if they're only willing to work hard enough. The reality, of course, is that our starting conditions dramatically impact our chances of success. Growing up in poverty means you're far less likely to become wealthy than those who were born in the middle class, let alone those who were born into wealth and privilege. We love to lift up those stories of someone who started as the poorest of the poor and ended up with great wealth. And then we use that thin story to show how this has to be true. But the individual examples run counter to our broader reality. Income inequality and social mobility are decreasing in our country. We know this. Little is being done to shift that tide, and it is time to rewrite that story. The stories we tell affect our own lives. They affect what we believe is possible for us. They affect our relationships, what's possible between and among us. They affect the wider world and whether we believe that justice and freedom and peace is really available to all of us. Stories matter. Many stories matter because stories have been used to dispossess and malign, and stories can also be used to empower and to humanize. Stories can break our hearts and our souls, and stories can be used to repair and to heal. So may we be willing to consider and reconsider the stories that we tell about ourselves and one another, our communities, and our world. Let us tell thick stories, rich in hope and in possibility. And in the telling, may we begin to make them true.